a culture change from an institution standpoint. And I think since, you know, many of myself and the my colleagues who have been at Innovation Partners, even the ones before me, they started this already, you know, they primed this kind of environment of innovation and entrepreneurship. And I think that's part of it. When you have an environment that's welcoming to innovation and entrepreneurship, you tend to get all these people out of the woodwork, and they were always there. Or you expose or enlighten, certain people who have never thought of it otherwise. You know, scientific perspective, so many grants out there. If you can find another route to commercialize or advance your science, and it happens to be through a startup or through another commercial route, why not?
Hi there, welcome back for another Macademia podcast episode. Myself, Ofer Izal Barnea, and Elena Itzkovich get together with fascinating people to explore different ways science and scientific careers can be developed outside of academia. Before we introduce our guest for today, we want to thank you, you, that join our Macademia group on Facebook, follow our account at MacademiaP on Twitter, rated our little project, liked our work, or shared it with a friend or colleague. This, aside from motivating us, support others to join this important conversation as we explore those very different ways of how science is much more than just academia. Today's guest, Dr. Dov Shamir, is an experienced scientist and an entrepreneur. He supports founders by providing both mentorship and guidance to develop their own platforms and help position their companies coming out of the Mount Sinai ecosystem. Dov is a senior manager at the entrepreneurship at Mount Sinai Innovation Partners, MSIP, and a key figure at Elemental Labs, the newly formed incubator program there, that really makes a connection from outside into the talent pool that it is. Mount Sinai system. We will talk about everything today, from how you find your passions within the PhD, which are not research and more business, how you go about in accomplishing those, and what is the uniqueness of the commercialization office in general and in Mount Sinai specifically. Enjoy it. Hello, Dov, and hello, Elena.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good.
Great to have you, Dov. Thank you for joining.
So, Dov, you are in the East Coast, Mount Sinai, New York, and you encompass things that we talk about a lot in this podcast, is the combination of great science and great business, and making both and making impact at the end, using both of them to make impact. So really, tell us about yourself. Give us your elevator pitch. Who is Dr. Dov Shamir?
So Dov Shamir, I'm the Senior Manager of Entrepreneurship at Mount Sinai Innovation Partners, which is the commercialization office of the Mount Sinai Health System. I also run our virtual incubator program called Elemental Labs, which focuses on best ways to strategically align startup companies with that of the entire health system at Mount Sinai. By training, I'm a PhD in neuroscience focused on immunotherapies for Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases. In a past life beyond that, I was also an entrepreneur and also a consultant as well.
Okay, that's a lot. And I promise I will do my best not to ask you what you think about the recent Alzheimer's drug approval. But I really make an effort. Let's go back. So you said you did your PhD in immunotherapy, and so during your PhD, what were your thoughts on career options? Because you were in a hot field, which is still very hot scientifically, and you can, I guess, go forward in an academic venture and really go deep into the field. So what did you thought about like career options then?
So actually getting into the PhD was not in my, I'd say if you asked me in high school or even in undergrad, that was not even a consideration initially. The PhD is something that just kind of happened over time. I was always interested in biology, but my first love was actually in economics. So I was an economics undergrad. But even though I was in that kind of in that econ finance business kind of territory, I was always interning at, you know, pharmaceutical companies and at bioengineering companies. And so I always, you know, my second love, biology, always kind of reared its head. And at some point or another, I was offered a research position as an undergrad at NYU Langone, where I got my first taste of real academic research. And it did hit every kind of every point of intellectual curiosity I could have possibly imagined. And I really liked it a lot. But within a year or two of my PhD itself, once I got beyond that, you know, through, you know, into the program at NYU Langone and actually started conducting research, I found out this isn't a long-term kind of career goal for myself. I know many of other options from my past lives. So, you know, I started doing as much as possible to actually explore other avenues of what, how you can leverage your PhD, you know, whether it be industry, consulting, finance, investing, startups, entrepreneurship, and even just as an inventor itself, right? I think a lot of PhDs do a lot of basic research and they don't always consider the translational aspects of the research. So that was something I happened to have a nice exposure to my own, you know, for my own thesis advisor. Because day one, we were working on a therapy that was being translated with Lundbeck out of Denmark. And so I was instantly exposed to that part of the science, so to speak. But it wasn't my own science, right? That was my, advisor's science. So how do you get to the point of inventing your own stuff and becoming a business savvy scientist? So that was kind of the next big question. And then I had to do a whole slew of other extracurricular activities to get me to that point, you know, career-wise.
So what kind of things did you decide to do in order to explore that direction?
I tried about everything. You know, everything from, you know, creating my own technology, which was a bioreactor system in the cardiology space, taking stem cells and creating more physiologically relevant and pathologically relevant cardiac models for drug testing or, you know, any other kind of purpose you can test the drugs on.
So that was part of your PhD?
Consulting.
Or is it after?
No, it was actually completely separate. It was in parallel to my PhD. I just had a good idea. Gosh. I had an idea. Spoke to my dean, and he said, you know, pursue this. Talk to our tech transfer office, and you know, see what's possible. They advised me, you know, on best practices on how to get financing for this early stage idea. I mean, it was literally a napkin drawing at the time when I brought it to my dean. And, you know, and then they found me some financing. They helped find a lab for myself to actually, you know, test it out in. And it was in a completely different department within NYU, actually. And I, you know, my PI was very supportive of this, as long as it didn't incur any negative effects on my, you know, PhD thesis itself, because he understood that, you know, he invented something. Why not myself? And then, you know, in addition to all that, you know, that kind of ran its course with the investigator in the cardiology department, got to the point of a minimum viable product. And, you know, got to do some investor pitches, some other industry pitches for it. It ended up the space was very crowded and there were a couple in other groups, especially at Columbia, that were way ahead of us on the technology front. But either way, it was a very good learning experience. And my first taste, I would say, of entrepreneurship and innovation.
That's cool. So you said that it was a crowded space, but you still went in and tried to make something out of it. Is like in retrospective, you think that today when you have more experience, would you deter from that? Would you stop earlier? Would you try to pivot on that? This first experience, how you look back in this first experience, if you can done something different?
I think I made all the classic innovator early entrepreneur mistakes, which is fine because I think part of that is it's a good learning experience and makes the next one better, right? So, you know, I would have done a couple things differently, probably would have pivoted a lot earlier, like you said. I would have probably done a bigger and deeper dive on the market itself. or try to go to some of those competing labs or other groups and say, hey, let's just work together instead of trying to do two parallel products.
Yeah, that's a great point, because we try to allude to that in many of our talks that, for example, if you want to do an entrepreneurship, if you want to go into translating your technology, it's the first pancake. The first pancake is always awful. Like you do all the mistakes, but you have to go through this first pancake. Make it, maybe put it aside. Maybe you have a fluke and it's awesome, but put it aside and learn everything from it. And that is, it's a learning curve, as you said, and you have to take this step forward. Did you, when going into the lab, you said that your PI was already an inventor, so he already been translating technology and working with pharma company. Was that a consideration, choosing the lab?
It was definitely a big plus for a variety of reasons. You know, as you know, when you're picking a lab, it's not just on the research topic. You also have to realize that you know something's going to be impactful potentially, right? And also that there's you know, something we don't like to talk about as much, I think, in as PhD students or postdocs, etc. But there has to be the financing behind the research, right? And if you're attached to some translational science, typically there's money there as well. So it means it means the PI can afford you as the student, and then there'll be resources for you to actually conduct the studies that needs to be done, and you don't have to pick and choose sometimes. The projects that might be more and I hate to say it, more experimental or more risky. And you can kind of, try many more things at one time, which is, again, something we don't like to talk about, but that's the economic side of me kind of talking right now. But it's something you have to at least consider.
So you ended up in a tech transfer office. So is that sort of, you link it back to this experience or?
Yeah. And it definitely helped. And I think it actually got me there, whether I realized it or not at the time. And we like to call ourselves actually a commercialization office, because tech transfer, it's the moving part of just literally like a factory, going through a factory where you go through one stage and it's very robotic. We're consider ourselves a commercialization office in the fact that we're not just trying to get a technology in and then out to another company. We're actually trying to create real products, maybe create startups around those products as well. It's something bigger and beyond just a typical tech transfer opportunity. But it certainly did help, because I go on a daily basis, I advise and mentor other inventors, other clinicians on how to basically get those good ideas out of the clinic or out of the lab and into something that can be packaged, essentially. They'll be attractive either to an industry partner, to be put in a startup, or find other research opportunities that maybe will bear more fruit. So without this experience, I don't think I'd be able to go to others and actually advise them how to essentially do the same thing, either from a napkin stage drawing or something very basic research that they've already conducted and published on a couple of big papers.
So I wonder how those conversations go. So I have my own experience with tech transfer, either like in the US or Israel, but from the other side, how does experience go? How you prepare yourself to talk to a professor or inventor who spent his entire life researching this molecule, this process, and he is like the world expert on that, and with everything, but has no idea about how to make it out as a business, how to translate it. How you prepare yourself to this conversation? How you keep this very delicate balance of maybe like nudging someone that is an expert in his field towards a more applicable way. You get what I mean, right? It's a very hard conversation to do, at least initially.
Yeah. So first and foremost, we're a service to the investigators and the clinicians in the health system. So we're there to help them at the end of the day. But at the same time, obviously balancing that with the fiduciary and other responsibilities of the institution as a whole, right? So we're representatives to the outside world, to industry, investors, other startups. So we have to balance that out a little bit. So we can't just take to those other partners externally ideas that make no sense, right? So there is a little bit of, managing expectations. But first and foremost, we're there to help the investigators get to their endpoints that they want to see as well. So those conversations go in a couple of different ways. A lot of times it's actually initiated by the investigator because they think they have a commercializable idea. And a lot of time that it, conversation is educating them on what is a commercializable idea and what point they have to get it to in the laboratory for us to go out there and essentially market the technology. So I'd say that's probably about 50% of the time what's going on is that educational component, because the scientists and the clinicians, they do what they do best. They do the science, they do things in the clinic, and you know, they're the experts, they're the resident experts in what they do. Our job is to help, you know, take that and help to translate as much as possible. And then the other 50% of the time, I would say it's a little bit of hand holding, you know, basically guiding them on, okay, maybe you should do these one or two experiments next. That'll be critical. Or, you know, provide us a little bit more, information on the market and the space that you're in, you know, whether it be competitive landscape, market analysis. And we guide them and help them through that process. We're not experts in every piece of science that comes through Mount Sinai's doors. We have to basically, there's a very fast learning curve when you deal with any investigators. So you kind of on the fly, you have to learn a lot, but we do still rely on them to a certain degree to tell us who else is out there, what else is going on, why is your particular solution the best thing that's come since maybe sliced bread? I don't know. So that's kind of what the other 50% is. And then the last little portion at the end is actually packaging it up, going to the investor, going to the industry partner, and actually trying to sell the technology. And if there's a there from their perspective, and they have their own screening, you know, criteria that don't always align with that of the scientists or the scientific academic perspective, but we try to get as close as possible to that.
So all this like development of pitch and actual pitching and selling the idea out, is this your responsibility? Do you do this? Do the tech transfer do this? Or you train the investigator that will eventually become the operator in the company to do that?
I think it depends a little bit on the investigator and the asset that's involved. Sometimes the asset requires a lot more technical explanation. So you need the PI there to delve into the technical aspects of the science and anything else that goes with the solution. When it's a more traditional, straightforward technology, I would say the business development manager is the one who probably handles that most of the time. But I can tell you right now firsthand, if you have a business savvy scientist or clinician who knows how to pitch, that makes everyone's life a lot easier either way. So anytime a scientist or clinician can actually learn these skill sets, I think it's better for everybody, whether it be for, you know, a tech transfer process or starting your own company. Whether, you know, either or just presenting your science in general at a conference, even.
So presenting your science in conference and pitching, so presenting your science in conference is a good training for business pitching?
From the technical aspect point and from the confidence point, I believe so. So someone who's never pitched before, hasn't pitched on a big stage, they're going to be really, I would say, nervous if they go into, you know, pitching in front of an investor for the first time. At least they have that confidence level. The pitches are a little different and the focus is very different. You know, when you pitch something at a conference, it's about where have you moved the story of your science? What have you discovered, right? When you're pitching your idea for a solution that can help a patient or translate science, it's what value you're bringing to the patient, what value you bring to the hospital system potentially or society. It's a little bit of a different, I would say, angle on the technology or on the science, and learning how to kind of pivot around to that point versus traditional science talk is very important. Also, not everything anyone wants to hear in a traditional startup pitch or a business pitch is applicable from a scientific pitch. I've seen many scientists go out there, pitch their ideas, and spend probably 90% of the time on the technical aspects and forget about the market or competitive landscape or the value add that their science actually brings to the patient or society. So, you know, there's a balance also of what you provide inside the pitch itself.
I wonder if to go back a little bit. So, you know, they develop the technology, but a lot of the time, the actual value that they can bring with their technology is not, you know, a direct path from what they were studying. So let's say they were studying one disease, but if you think really hard, you can find a different disease that the same technology can be much more useful, much, you know, easier to commercialize, and so on. Is it something that you sort of help them think through? And if yes, then do you have sort of specific ways or sort of, I don't know, creative thinking strategies that you might use in order to reach that specific target that could be more valuable?
So you are correct that a lot of the time when a technology is brought to us, then the intention is for one application or one patient group or one customer. And I'm going to use the word customer, I think, going forward for at least this particular question. We really do push the concept, the Steve Blank concept from Lean Startup methodology of customer discovery. So whether it be a traditional therapeutic or digital asset, whatever, it doesn't matter. Everything has a customer at the end of the day, and you have to figure out if your customer archetype fits the value adds of the essentially the solution that you're creating, and those features make sense at the end of the day. So sometimes I think in biology, you can find targets that hit multiple, you can find multiple molecules that hit multiple targets, or maybe one target. When it comes to some other assets, maybe, it's not as clear, but we expect that. I would say that background research and talking to other, key players within the field that you're working in is kind of a must if you're going to go try to sell something. So we expect if you bring a solution to us that you've at least talked to five other people, let's say, and I'm just using an arbitrary number five, it could be 20, depending on the solution, that may use your technology or have some influence on buying the technology or promoting the technology, right? So if you don't convince those people within the orbit of the solution that it's actually good and that those feature sets make sense, then, if we bring it then to a potential manufacturer or some other company to license it to, they're going to see the same thing and the writing on the wall. So doing all that kind of background research, whether it be primary research in the case of the customer discovery and actually speaking to people, or secondary research and actually, doing the PubMed search, doing your Google searches, looking through all the citations, both are very necessary before you come and provide a solution and want to kind of go a certain direction with it.
So before we maybe dive in into the very interesting ecosystem of Mount Sinai and your role in the innovation partners, I have a question of my own about like innovation within. So our main audience is comprised of PhD students and postdocs. So we have talked until now about the PI innovator that is the head of the lab. But let's say in a situation that the PI is not interested, but the subordinates, the postdoc, the PhD is interested in taking it out. Is there something holding him back, or how does it work? How do you need to accommodate for the quote unquote needs of everyone in the innovator list? PI is an innovator. The student is an innovator. How you work this out when only one side is interested?
So I think at the end of the day, it's still a conversation between the PI and their postdoc and or the student. If they can't come to some consensus, I don't think that's the job of the tech transfer to force it. The PI is the one who's typically the inventor on the technology. Now, if you have a scenario where the student or the postdoc is an inventor of a technology, disclose the technology to us, a lot of times it's still under a PI's lab. So that's the resources that they're using. It's still a conversation between both. But I would say there's a different balance in the relationship at that point. And coming from my perspective as someone who invented something in parallel to my own thesis research, I was able to go into that tech transfer office at NYU, and I was essentially the PI on the project. And I was only a student at that point, but I was treated as if I was the PI, right? So I think it depends on where the solution was originally started, who was essentially bankrolling that solution, because whoever's lab or resources were used, you have to consider that as part of influencing or an input into the solution or the creation of that solution. And at the end of the day, I think that most PIs who already are relatively innovative or I'd say translational focused, we'll find a way to work things out with their students or postdocs and make accommodations. I've not seen a case yet that it has not gone that way. At least, in my time in academia and still here at Sinai, but each individual is a little different. So it could still, at the end of the day, the PI could still shut down the solution. I have seen another archetype though, where you have a PI who's really enthusiastic about creating a new technology, creating a startup specifically, right? But can't or won't want to leave the institution, their full-time job as an investigator, to go do it. So a lot of times they ask the student or the postdoc to essentially be that champion or that entrepreneurial lead to go forward and essentially create the technology beyond the institution. So that I've seen as another archetype where it's less, I'd say, confrontational. It's more, you know, everyone's definitely going the same direction, and it's in startup as opposed to just internal development.
And that's cool. My main concern is that you don't see the former type because of this relation.
They don't reach him, exactly, right? If they have the conversation and it doesn't work, then it kills it before.
Or they're afraid even to do this conversation, which I think is just try it out. I don't think you need to hold back. There is, as you say, though, there is the tech transfer office, that the commercialization office that will help you if the idea is valid and will help the idea go out of academia. But you should try. I'm, as I mentioned at the beginning, so my sentence, it's like I'm afraid that because of this like very tight relationship that is very long term and very dependent between a PI and a junior researcher in the lab, the junior researcher holds back. If he really wants to push it forward, but he doesn't really think that he has a partner, and you say, just try it.
Just try it. I mean, look, every relationship, PI, student, or postdoc relationship is a little different, right? And I think it also depends on where the idea is originally originating from. And the PI has to balance that out with a future, you know, they're creating a future colleague at the end of the day. So if they want to have a relationship with that future colleague, you know, they want to make the relationship as positive as possible, obviously not destroying the focus of the lab at the same time. So you should definitely try. I just one step back. And again, I'm coming from a perspective where the technology I was creating as a student was an engineering feat. It was mechanical and electrical engineering that we were housing these cardiomyocytes, you know, derived from stem cells from. So the actual invention, the novelty, was something I was able to literally create in my apartment. Nothing that I had to, you know, start in the lab. And at that point, it was just selling that solution or that concept to an existing lab that had the stem cells and that knew how to create these kind of cells and knew the molecular and cellular biology behind them. So it was a little bit of a different relationship and different perspective. If you're talking about something that the student or postdoc, you know, comes and has an aha moment about a particular molecular mechanism or target, and it's something that's being done in the laboratory, I can see that there's going to be some hesitance, if you will, to go to the PI. But I think it's healthy to go and, you know, say, this is my idea. Let's do like one or two experiments to prove it. If it doesn't work, okay, then you prove me wrong. If it works, let's continue forward with it.
Yeah, I think it's a great message to our listeners, really, pushing forward in that. So Mount Sinai, it is a brand name. Let's talk about this for a minute. What is the uniqueness of Mount Sinai ecosystem, and what is the role of the innovation in pushing forward research and translation?
So the uniqueness in the ecosystem, I think, is, you know, if you compare us to our regional partners like Columbia or NYU, they have undergrad populations attached to them, other grad schools attached to them. Our health system is a health system that has a medical school and a graduate school attached, and that's it. So this ecosystem is in many ways smaller and very focused, because when you talk about other university, you know, systems, right? You have physics departments, chemistry departments, computer science departments. We're just medicine and biology. And that's, so it's a very, and healthcare more broadly. So it's a very extreme focus. That's number one for our ecosystem. And then it's a little, I would say, smaller in many ways. That being said, though, we're about 40,000 plus employees at the institution. And we see thousands and thousands upon thousands of, you know, patients every day as well. So there are a lot of people who go through our doors, and technically we can service as innovation partners. We don't just see the PIs and the clinicians as our potential, you know, and I'm going to call them kind of like clients or people we can help serve, but it's technically anybody. It could be the nurse, it could be a program manager, it could be anyone else in the corporate offices, or literally anybody at the institution of those 40,000 individuals. You have a good idea, you should come to us with that idea, and we can help find a path, you know, if it's a solution or not, to either pump it through the system or help manage the solution in such a way so you get to see if it is even possible to create and prototype, etc. The uniqueness, though, of our system also is, I think, we have a lot of different programs running simultaneously that are all very hyper-focused on healthcare and medicine. And at the end of the day, the focus is the patient. Our mission at the end of the day is we are the commercialization office, so we can help our patients and society as a whole. That's literally, you know, a line out of our book there. And because we're in such proximity to the patients, and because a lot of the ideas come from the investigators and clinicians that are literally seeing patients or, you know, walking, like literally either in the clinic or like pass them by, even casually or on a passive, perspective, you really get a better sense of who you're trying to help and serve and what solutions can actually come out of it. So I would say that's also a very unique aspect that you don't get at another big university system. You go to Columbia, you go to NYU, the hospital is separate from the rest of the university. You're not like in an Ohio State kind of scenario where everybody is in one campus together, the medical school, the undergrad, social work school, whatever it is. You know, in most universities, they're separate to some degree. And even in Ohio State that I just said is on the same campus, campus is huge. You may never see those same people ever again on those big campuses. But at Mount Sinai, we're all under, even though it's 8 hospitals, one main hospital, and all of us are kind of housed under the same umbrella. And you see those patients that you're trying to help on a daily basis.
So close to impact.
Yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about what you actually do? So say there is a team, a lab that has a good idea that they're thinking of commercializing. So they go to you from day one. So how does the process look like?
Yeah, and I can do from my perspective because, you know, the office as a whole, we have disclosures of technology that it's an electronic system that we, you know, pick up on the ideas and then we start evaluating them from there. But from my perspective, where I'm kind of going from this raw state where they're not even sure if they should even be disclosing a technology, we have a bunch of outreach events. We have our entrepreneurship bootcamp, our tech launch pad, Elementa Labs, all these, and basically run about 20 to 30 modules a year that focus on teaching individuals within the institution on everything that's entrepreneurship and commercialization. And we find that educational aspect is a good hook to getting people who are even thinking this way. And then through those modules and lectures, we end up interacting with them and start learning about what they're interested in creating and interested in doing. And then normally that ideation begins to happen. We even have a formal module on design thinking. And we actually go through some exercises for prototyping, market sizing. So they get to see every step along the way of what they need to do. We, in parallel, will work with them to figure out those ideas. And then if we get to the point where the idea has sufficient merit, and let's say it's not even prototyped yet, we may say, you know, it's a digital solution, it might be worth disclosing. If it's something that they can actually prototype on their own and move forward, even better. And if we have something tangible we can look at, great. And we're technology agnostic. We look at everything. We look at devices. We look at digital. We look at IT, SaaS, therapeutics. So really the sky's the limit on what people can come to us with. And we have all that expertise in-house to be evaluating those technologies in real time.
So so who goes through these programs? Is it just for students or do you see PIs going sort of to your programs?
So I would say a good chunk are postdocs and PhD or master students, maybe let's say around 50%. And the other 50%, everybody else. We have PIs, we have clinicians, we have fellows, we have attendings. Basically anyone at the institution who's remotely interested in this stuff, the bootcamp is essentially a playground to start innovating, talking with those like-minded individuals, start learning from people in the ecosystem. So people who are lecturing, it's not just people from innovation partners. We actually get people regionally and nationally to come speak And in some ways, the pandemic this year was very fortunate for us because we were able to get national involvement as well. So people from California, people from, you know, Israel, people from basically anywhere, you know, we can find them essentially and who has an internet connection. So they hear from experts, they connect with those experts, they hear those case studies, and they see things that are tangible, not tangible. And it creates a good atmosphere.
That's great. It's great because I think a lot of the times we sort of talk about how when you are a PhD or a postdoc student, what you see is a mentor that is very focused on academia. Whereas projects like ours, like the podcast, we talk to these postdocs and students. And a lot of the times the barrier to sort of thinking outside of academia, if it's for a startup or for a career path, is the problem that the PIs will not be interested or don't have the knowledge or sort of have not seen what's happening outside of academia. And it seems like through your programs, you're sort of, you know, you're making the gap a bit smaller and the PIs can be part of the conversation.
So I'll give you a really good example. We had a team this year in our boot camp that ended up in our tech launchpad and even in our pitch challenge that had, it was a multidisciplinary team. They had a postdoc, they had a PhD student, and they had attending and maybe a couple medical students involved. And because of the pandemic, they never met in person. And as a result, one of them needed actually some surgery and ended up, the physician of the group was an ENT. They met for the first time when the ENT was giving her surgery that day. So you get a very unique kind of experience at Sinai because, you know, we're putting all these people in the boot camp. They all meet on various capacities and you can actually be interacting with them on other capacities in the institution as well. And, you know, I don't think most of us would have that kind of relationship with our co-founder, you know. And by the way, it was completely
hopefully
like,
not.
You know, they didn't know it was going to happen. It was like, this is the ENT that was designed right at the end of the day. And it, you know, it's a very unique experience. We've had, you know, physicians that just came out of surgery, all scrubbed up into these modules. You get a good sense of they're really doing stuff in there. And then you have PIs coming in who have wealth of experience and who are coming from years and years and years of studying certain areas and can bestow that scientific or I would say professional experience to the PhD and master students who are there on a very different capacity that's not, you know, typical, right? It's more life experience, it's more about general professional development. It's less about, oh, this is what, you know, this is what experiment I did today and this is what the significance I showed of that, you know, of that particular experiment. So it's in a very different capacity. You can see the PIs who are involved. And you know, I'm happy to say that the majority of the groups who went into our pitch challenge this year actually were physicians and PIs. There were students as well, but you know, in past years, these are traditionally just student run, you know, these are students heavy. And this year we actually had a lot of PIs and physicians. And I think it showed a good example to the rest of the student body and the postdocs on what's possible. Cause this was not traditional even science for some of them going into it. It was very much applying their science in a very different fashion that typically is not, I would say, taught in the graduate schools or even the postdoc programs.
So you think it's a part of general change in the like a generational change in the PI cohort, in the PI level, that you get more PI involved and there they see that it's important to maintain a closer to impact kind of research in the lab?
I think it's a culture change from an institution standpoint. And I think since, you know, many of myself and my colleagues who have been at Innovation Partners, even the ones before me, they started this already, you know, they primed this kind of environment of innovation and entrepreneurship. And I think that's part of it. When you have an environment that's welcoming to innovation and entrepreneurship, you tend to get all these people out of the woodwork and they were always there or you expose or enlighten, certain people who have never thought of it otherwise. When I was at NYU as a graduate student, I first started, they didn't even have an entrepreneurship institute. There was no entrepreneurship going on from a kind of a grassroots, you know, a PI, you know, lab level. By the time I left, it was left and right. these kind of activities happening. And, you know, I know on the West Coast, this has been happening at universities for a lot longer than it probably has been here in the East Coast. But, you know, that was, I think, a decision that was made in many of these institutions regionally that, you know, this is an important factor. Things are more translational. And, you know, this is a good way of applying your science as well at the end of the day. I think, you know, coming from the scientific perspective, there's only so many grants out there. If you can find another route to commercialize or advance your science and it happens to be through a startup or through another commercial route, why not? Right. As long as, you know, everything's, you know, in line with your institutional policies, you know, it's a good deal.
Yeah, definitely. Again, in my mind, it's like a chicken and egg kind of question. If do you need those courses and the reputation for the institution to attract those more prone PIs in, or you need those PIs first and then the institution just supports them? I guess there is no right answer, but it connects to a different question I had. How like scalable do you think the model you build in Mount Sinai? If I am interested, I come from a different university as administration or as a student body, can I copy paste it to another institute with similar features? Let's say Tel Aviv University in Israel, which has a lot of hospitals assigned to it and a very good medical and biological grad school.
So, I mean, I think a lot of the activities we do, a lot of the programs we have, you can see a lot of these things at other institutions, right? So, you know, we didn't, you know, create something completely new, I would say. I would say what's unique though is the team that's behind it and that's dedicated behind it. Because you have a group like Innovation Partners, you know, at Mount Sinai, or a group at NYU like the Entrepreneurial Institute that's willing to really spearhead these opportunities. And I really call them opportunities. They're not just classes, right? The fact that you can network with people from industry, other career paths at these events, those are opportunities. That's not just education at the end of the day. And that people, you know, these institutions are willing to put, you know, take the time and energy to attract them, right? It's not just they come, right? You have to find the people that make sense for the institution. So it's scalable in the fact that it's not, these aren't all new things on a pragmatic end. It is novel in the fact that you have to have certain individuals really ready to be dedicated to it. It's scalable if you can essentially teach those next stage, you know, of individuals and leaders to kind of go out there and kind of be the go-getters, be the entrepreneurs and recreate these things. And we have a fellows program that we run annually that's for internal as well as external individuals. That's a leadership program that teaches you how to best evaluate technologies coming from our perspective. So you learn everything from top down entrepreneurship and commercialization high level, and then even get into the nitty gritty about intellectual property, finance, real estate, you know, market analysis, competitive analysis, sector intelligence, whatever it is. You learn all those granular items as well, but coming from our perspective. And it, at the end of that particular process, there's a capstone project where you evaluate a technology that we provide you, and you essentially, you know, make a determination if we should add it into our portfolio or not. So we're, in some ways, we're creating the next generation or the next set of leaders who can essentially do the same thing. You know, albeit it's in one particular boot camp or program, but, you know, in that regard, it's a scale, well, I wouldn't call it scalable, but at least repeatable model that hopefully will be exported to other institutions, and not just institutions, but firms as well. So people in law, people in, you know, equity research, you know, real estate, et cetera.
That's very cool. So is it an online program, the fellowship?
This last year and this year, they are going to be remote. So there's going to be online. We take about 50% of our cohorts are external. So it could be anybody. And you don't even have to be a student or postdoc. We have individuals who are, you know, operators within the ecosystem, other, I would say, employees, program managers. We've had attendings as well in these programs, fellows. So it could be basically anybody. As long as you are, I would say, dedicated and you know, you really want to get and learn these kind of processes and have that kind of enthusiasm, I'd say that's the top, you know, one thing we're looking at. Obviously, if you have some other background in IP or business, et cetera, that's always a plus.
That's fantastic.
So when the applications are due?
I believe this year, August 20th is when we're accepting applications up until.
That's my birthday. It's a sign.
Happy birthday. And we normally start the program in earnest in October and into December.
It sounds amazing. And we should include the link to it in the episode description. Most of our talk, we talked about like a sort of germination of technology and ideas within the Mount Sinai labs. Is there an opposite direction going in? Companies want to link with Mount Sinai, have a need, have no idea how to solve it, and they're coming to you or to the system in general and say, listen, we have a problem in X. We have no idea how to solve it. Can you find us a partner within? We will fund it. Does that go through you?
So that has traditionally gone through our group. We recently operationalized the process through Elemental Labs, which focuses on external startups that want to work with institution on a strategic basis and grow with institution. Now, in terms of finding the PI or finding the individual, we always recommend that the company suggests us some individuals that they would want to work with, kind of a wish list. So we understand the archetype of the potential champion they would want to work with at the institution. It may not be the person they work with in the end. Obviously, we have a group of people in our steering committee who can make suggestions beyond that. And sometimes the champions they suggest are just not available, right, to do these activities. But that is our process to essentially work in a very strategic manner with startups where it's a bidirectional relationship. And we can really work with the startup going forward and not just on a client basis.
So it also gives an opportunity for students and postdocs to sort of advise to companies, to startups?
So we the fellows program that I mentioned before, in part two of it in the spring, where the fellows actually can shadow active projects, they actually got opportunities to look at these companies and help in the evaluation process. So it gave them kind of a firsthand look on how these negotiations go, how pitches are presented to the institution, and even get some back-end look at what some of the agreements look like.
Very cool.
That's very cool. So Elemental Lab is when a project actually happens, okay? And you find your champion within Mount Sinai. Does someone just physically move? Does Elemental Lab has like a physical entity, which is different from the PI's lab?
So Elemental Labs, it's a virtual incubator. And so the company would have to have its own space elsewhere. So its own address. But they could potentially collaborate and co-develop technologies within the PI's lab if that's what we end up, essentially agreeing upon going forward with the company, if that's the strategic relationship. Maybe they'll provide some of the research tools. Maybe we'll provide some of those research tools. It really depends on a company per company basis and which technology modalities we're talking about. Obviously, if it's a digital technology, we have IT questions. If it's something that has to just be implemented in somebody's lab, it sometimes could be, that's a whole other story because it's based on the capabilities of that particular laboratory.
I think we covered so much and I think it's amazing. So you're, as I mentioned in the beginning, you're the combination of business and science and how you make both of them work to make an impact. And it's very interesting because the perspective is amazing. Just before we wrap up, is there, circling all the way back to your PhD and grad and after those 2 years, you realize that, okay, this research life is not for me. We always would like to encourage our listeners to ask themselves those tough questions and understand what are the values. So what are the questions that you think, like in retrospective, you can tell this beginning of grad school Dov, to ask himself or anyone else basically to make sure that the path they're on is the path that suits them best.
I mean,
it's a big question.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you have to do what makes you happy and what drives you. From a from the PhD perspective and intellectual capacity, it was great for me, right? So I was always happy in learning new things, constantly challenging myself to discover new things. But, you know, that wasn't a repeatable and scalable model for myself. And I'm going to use the startup kind of terms for that. You know, it wasn't scalable for me at the end of the day. It didn't get me excited enough, you know, because same problem maybe every day. But, you know, you have to find what works for you. And at what I had to do, and again, PhD is kind of this weird term, kind of like engineers, you know, there's not a standard path, not like being a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer, right? So, you know, you do the school and you move on. And you kind of have to try a little bit of everything, and that what makes kind of what clicks. And sometimes it's just you go down that natural gradient of what clicks. And I tried almost everything under the sun. I did pro bono consulting with Insight Fellows. I, you know, interned for an angel investment group. I did my own startup. I did my own technology. So I tried a ton of different things, you know, saw what stuck. And at the end of the day, combination of what stuck and what I liked, and the two kind of mixed together. And I found myself an innovation partners at Mount Sinai.
Great. I think this is great advice. Like really, and we all always try to encourage people, ask questions, like try stuff out. Opportunities are out there. And even do your own innovation. You had the chance to have an idea, work it out a bit, and then follow it through. As you said, it was you did all the novice mistakes. I can share the same, and but you learned from that and grew from that. What? Just final question. What do you see, like the next challenge for you?
Well, as we just started Elemental Labs, so you know, day one at Innovation Partners, I wanted to run an incubator. I want to, you know, work more closely with startups that weren't just in the institution. So, you know, the next set of challenges for myself is, you know, I think starting to grow and learn how to put a, you know, portfolio of companies together, and, you know, learning a little bit more about those processes, not just from a investor standpoint, but, you know, a strategic standpoint, because we're not, you know, we're investing our time and energy into these companies. So finding that balance between growing portfolio, understanding what's kind of the new and next exciting set of technologies and solutions, and making sure that at the end of the day, we'll still meet our mission and vision for the institution, as well as our patients at the end. What will have the most impact on those patients? And, you know, hopefully good things happen beyond that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to end up, the impact on the patients. I think that's like most of us got into science for that, and you and the innovation partners help make it true. So really thank you for your time and this great conversation.
Yeah, I think it's
thank you.
It's a really interesting path where you sort of start from science and all the way through sort of helping other companies sort of come up and focus on the patients and impact that they can bring. I think it's a great trajectory where I think we see it often that we don't always understand the path that we are following through, but sometimes when you're sort of looking retrospectively, it all of a sudden makes much more sense. So good luck on your mission. It sounds very interesting. I want to invite you to Macademia Forum. I'm sure others will enjoy and sort of learn a lot from your path and your experience. And thank you. Thank you for your time and for sharing your story.
Thank you both.